comes to Kingston real estate, local experience matters. Kim Purcell is an award-winning realtor born and raised in Kingston with over a decade of experience and 100 five-star reviews. If you want honest advice and results you can trust, choose Kim. Visit kimpurcell.ca today for more information.
Welcome to Electronic Intifada Radio. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. On this episode, escalation on all fronts. We speak with Setare Sadiki, a professor at the University of Tehran.
It's about two terrorist states attacking an independent nation because it dared resist imperialism. It is totally connected. It cannot be disconnected. It's the same struggle that Palestinians, Lebanese, and Iranians, and people in the region have against the Zionist regime. And we're just a continuation of the same struggle.
And on the Resistance Report, John Elmer covers the third week of the war.
Iran's strategy, knocking out radar systems upon which the aerial defense array is dependent, preparing for a long war. They have been targeting these high-value targets early in the war that will make the later stages of the war a lot more difficult for the U.S. and Israel to defend, and the Gulf states are already way in over their head.
This is Electronic Intifada Radio. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. This episode highlights the news, interviews, and reports from our live stream broadcast on March 19th, 2026. The United States and Israel launched their war of aggression against Iran, aiming to topple its system of government and neutralize it as a sovereign, independent power. But having failed to achieve the quick success that they expected after the assassination of Iran's leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, the United States and Israel have only escalated their attacks on Iran's population, as well as its civilian, cultural, and economic infrastructure. Iran's health ministry said that more than 18,000 people have been injured in the attacks. Among more than 1,300 people killed are more than 200 children and 226 women. On March 11th, the World Health Organization said it had verified 18 attacks on healthcare facilities in Iran since February 28th. Resulting in 8 deaths among healthcare workers. On March 18th, Israel and the United States escalated the war even further by bombing vital Iranian gas production and storage facilities, halting production at 2 refineries. Within hours, Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps ordered people living near key energy production facilities in Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and the United Arab Emirates to evacuate as retaliation looked certain. We're joined now from Isfahan in Iran by Dr. Setare Sadiki to discuss the situation. She's an assistant professor at the Faculty of World Studies at the University of Tehran. She holds a PhD in North American Studies and researches Iran-U.S. relations, sanctions, and media narratives. Welcome to Electronic Intifada Radio, Dr. Setare. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for the invitation.
So good to have you.
Thank you. Isfahan is a major city of over 2 million people in central Iran, and it's also renowned for its Persian and Islamic cultural treasures, including the Ali Kapoor Palace, the Jame Mosque, and the Hesht Behesht Palace. It's also the city where you are from and from where you're speaking to us. Tell us about the war's impact on your life and the life of people in Isfahan right now.
Yeah, I mean, ever since the war started, the majority of the attacks have been on Tehran, the capital city, but Isfahan is the second city that has come under the most number of attacks and airstrikes by the United States and the Zionist regime. It's not as massive as it has been in Tehran, but it's been happening almost on a daily basis, some days less than others. We're hearing jets flying over the city almost every day, and sometimes explosions. There have been a few attacks on military facilities, but also on residential areas. A couple of days ago, they targeted an entire residential building and a supermarket and a car exhibition nearby. Five or six people were shopping at the supermarket. All of them died on the spot. Entire houses were destroyed under airstrikes. And there was an attack on the day when the new leader was announced and people were taking to the streets to pledge allegiance to the new leader. During the daytime, there was an attack on the government building, which was next to the Naqsh-e Jahan Square, which is part of this Safavid era historical masterpiece, which has the Ali Ghapu Palace, the Jame Mosque, and Sheikh Lutfullah Mosque. People were, rallying, and they were in the square, and the attack happened right next to the square, killing a few people in the government building and destroying parts of the historical buildings in Ashraf Hall, which is part of the government building, on Chehel Satun Palace, which is a more than 400-year-old, UNESCO heritage site with very beautiful mirror works and paintings on the wall that depict the battles that the Safavid era and the previous eras had. Parts of the Ali Ghapu Palace were also damaged on an attack a few days before that. Because of the shock waves, part of the tiles on the Abbasi Jame Mosque and the same square were also damaged. And we're talking about hundreds of years of cultural heritage that have been listed by UNESCO World Heritage Sites. And they have all come under attack by two powers that are combined are younger than these palaces. And a lot of Iranians are seeing that as an attack on their civilization, on thousands of years old civilization and cultural heritage. But it's also been taking the lives of innocent civilians. On another attack, a family were just driving in their car and they happened to be nearby the place that was attacked, and which happened to be actually a research center affiliated with IRC, but it was a research center, and young scientists were killed there. As I said, families have been killed just passing by or just shopping somewhere. But on the other side of the story is thousands of people taking to the streets every single night, taking on the streets to show support for the Islamic Republic of Iran, but also to demand revenge. I've been attending these gatherings, and one of the main slogans every night has been that no compromise, no negotiations, we'll fight against America. And this is what people demand. And this is very clearly the message that the people have. On Al-Quds Day rally also, I was in Isfahan and I attended the rally. And it was, the square was packed with people. It took us a long time to be able to just move out of the palace, which is the second largest palace in the entire world. It's a huge place, and it was packed with people. And again, the message was the same, that we don't want negotiations, we don't want compromise, and we just want to fight the U.S. and the Zionist regime until our sovereignty is protected.
The point you made about these two states, the U.S. and Israel, jointly bombing one of the oldest civilizations on the planet, and combined, they're just, a few hundred years old. And of course, in Gaza, over the last 2.5 years of the genocide, we saw the systematic destruction of these, millennia-old structures, the great Omari Mosque in Gaza City, these World Heritage Sites, these sites that have been stewarded by Palestinians for thousands of years, protected, and just in a few seconds, they're bombed, you know, to dust, along with the systematic destruction of hospitals and schools, infrastructure, roads, clinics, universities. And over the last 18 days, of course, we have also seen the U.S. and Israel systematically bomb schools all over Tehran. Can you talk a little bit about this important connection that people in Iran have to the people of Palestine and how it's not just symbolic or solidarity in slogans, but it's actually a real material solidarity and a connection, really, that both Palestinians and Iranians are fighting against?
I see it as two settler colonial states attacking thousands of years old civilization that are indigenous to this part of the world, be it Palestine, Lebanon, Iraq, Syria, and Iran. And we have the same enemy. I mean, you know that one of the reasons that Iran has come under attack and the Islamic Republic has been targeted with sanctions, with assassinations, terrorist attacks, and all sorts of hostility, actually, is because Iran did not want to forsake Palestine, because we see the attack on Iran as an extension of that colonial project. We see how the peace in the region only possible when this colonial project is terminated, and the stability of the region and the prosperity for the people in the region cannot be achieved until there is a settler colonial project that is acting with absolute impunity, protected, funded, and supported by not only the United States, but also all the so-called international organizations, including the United Nations. We watched live stream the genocide of the Palestinians for 2 years, and the international organizations or so-called international community did nothing to stop it. Iranians see, you know, the Zionist regime as the same enemy. We have the, we all in the region, the Lebanese, Iranians, we have the same enemy, and we are from this region. And that's why you say, like, people are impressed by how Palestinians in Gaza, despite all the bombs that have been dropped on, as you said, hospitals, schools, houses, mosques, like the Zionist regime trying to obliterate anything that is, you know, Palestinian, that is a symbol of life in Palestine. And still nobody wants to leave their land because they are from there. Unlike the Zionist settlers who have been promised a better land, and from, I don't know, 2,000 years ago, 3,000 years ago, they were promised a piece of land, and they just came there and stole other people's lands. And now when they see Iranian missiles coming their way, they just want to flee because they're not from there. They're not indigenous to this land. But you see the same thing with Iranians. I mean, a lot of Iranians, I've talked to family members and friends who do have the option. Obviously, not everyone has that option, but some people have the option to, for example, go to rural areas or places where there's less bombing, or even leave their countries, but they don't want to go. What we're actually seeing is that Iranians living abroad are coming through the border, like driving, I mean, flying to Turkey, and then from there crossing the border because they want to be here when the war happens. This is the difference between the indigenous people of this region and the settler colonial residents of these occupied territories. And people probably have seen this beautiful interview with an Iranian mother who was out on the streets in Tehran holding her baby, when the interviewer asks her, what if this war goes into, like, you know, the cutting of water and electricity? And she's like, okay, and then you won't be able to, you know, change your baby's diapers easily. And she's like, what's the difference between me and my baby and the Palestinian children? We're the same. We saw what they did to the Palestinians, and we know that's the nature of our enemy, but we still want to resist. We would pay any price possible in order to fight back and not let them continue bullying the indigenous people of this region. And that's exactly what, I mean, it's not easy wondering, like, every time we hear the jets flying over, like, where they're going to bomb? Are my loved ones going to survive? And having to check on them. It's very difficult, but we are very willing to pay the price in order to see an end to this colonial project and the bullying and the aggression that comes from the imperialist power and the Zionist entity. So it is totally connected. It cannot be disconnected. It's the same struggle that Palestinians, Lebanese, and Iranians, and people in the region have against the Zionist regime. And we're just a continuation of the same struggle.
Iran confirmed the death of Dr. Ali Larijani, Iran's senior national security advisor, a well-known scholar. This came after an Israeli attack on a home of a member of his family. It killed him and his son and other people in the neighborhood, as I understand. Since the murder of Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, the start of this aggression, Israel and the United States have continued to target senior Iranian officials, both military and political officials. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu believes these murders will weaken the government and create a vacuum to bring about regime change. They've stated that's the goal openly. You've talked about how people have reacted, coming out into the streets, demanding revenge, showing their support. Talk a bit more about that. Is this war, and we know the Western and American and particularly Israeli way of warfare, if we can even call it that, is to target civilians and civilian infrastructure with the idea that if you make the civilian population suffer enough, they will turn on their leaders. That has been the practice in Lebanon for many decades, and now it was certainly the approach in Gaza as well and across Palestine. Collective punishment in the hope of turning people against their leaders. Is that working in Iran? Is it going to work if this war goes on long enough? What's your reaction to that?
Yeah, I mean, collective punishments of the people has always been a tool of imperialist powers and the Zionist regime. I mean, sanctions are a form of collective punishments against the Iranian people, and the United States and the Zionist regime were hoping that they would help turn the population against the establishment. And it's in some ways it did work, because especially the sanctions, because it's more difficult to pinpoint and identify the actual enemy, and you can, it's easier to blame the government. But when it comes to taking out the leaders and the officials, especially when there is a total disregard of civilians' lives and civilian infrastructure, does the exact opposite. I mean, the top figure that they could take out in Iran was Imam Khamenei, and he was the most popular spiritual and political figure in Iran, and they took him out. And what happened after that was that a lot of people, I mean, on the streets, you can see even people who took part in the January protest are now on the streets demanding revenge. And they understand that this is not only about their officials, it's about Iran as a country with the integrity that it has, with the territorial integrity that it has. It's Iran as a sovereign nation that is a target of the Zionist and the imperialist powers' aggression. It's not the Islamic Republic, because if it was only the Islamic Republic, then why do you strike schools? Why do you strike health centers? They have attacked IVF clinics, residential areas. Like in one neighborhood in Tehran, which is known as a working class neighborhood, they obliterated a total neighborhood with a lot of people living. Like in one case, an entire family of six members died in their houses. And how can you turn the population against their own government, which is right now the force that is resisting and that is protecting the sovereignty of the nation and the lives of its people? I mean, it's trying to protect the lives of its citizens. It has never proven effective in the past, as you said, in Palestine, in Lebanon. I mean, in Lebanon also, we're seeing images of entire residential building blocks coming down and the airstrikes. And even those who are probably not very pro-Hezbollah can actually see what the Zionist regime is about. It's about occupying Lebanese territories. It's about occupying Iranian territories, Palestinian territories. I mean, what they have done, like on the school, the attack on the school in Minab that killed almost 200 schoolgirls when they were in session. How can you justify that as an attack on the Islamic Republic? It's an attack on Iranian civilians. And they always used, you know, that they have used the same tactics in Palestine too. But in Iran, they always do this double tap technique. When rescuers and first aiders rush to help the people, then they attack the rescuers. They did the same thing today again in Lar, which is a smaller town in Fars province. So it's very clear that they find their enemies, the Iranian people, the Palestinian people, the Lebanese people, not only the government. And it has become very clear to the people. So it actually turns those who were critical of the government against the aggression, against those who are attacking Iran. And as I said, we're seeing people who did take part in the protests in January, taking to the streets to support their government's retaliation and demanding revenge. I mean, we have tried the path of diplomacy several times, and we were targeted during negotiations. So it has become very clear to the people that we tried everything that we could to avoid this war. And our officials had warned that once you start, we're going to retaliate. And this is going to be very different from the 12 days war. And they're doing exactly what they said. They have been steadfast in telling the truth to the people. I mean, they also confirmed the assassination of the Minister of Intelligence, Iran's Minister of Intelligence. And they just announce it. They don't hide it. Unlike, like, you know, in the Zionist regime, you don't know who's alive and who is not. And you always have these rumors because it's the individuals do matter more. Here, it's a system. It's a very well-established structure, which despite all the maybe shortcomings that it might have, it's functioning very well. It's not surrounded and relying only on individuals. There is an ideology, there is a structure that continues to function, and people have realized that, and they want to be a part of this existential war and protect their country against the foreign invasion.
People see that it was very clear that Ayatollah Imam Khamenei was targeted, and the information has come out that he refused to go to a safe place. He remained in his house. His family remained with him. It seems to be the same with Dr. Larijani. He was clearly aware that he was to be targeted, and apparently he didn't go to a bunker or to one of the tunnels in the mountains. And people look at that from outside Iran, even people who are sympathetic to Iran, and they say, what are you doing? You should go to a safe place. The leaders in Iran seem to see it differently. There is the story that Imam Khamenei said, I don't know what the source is, but it seems very, very credible to me, that he said, well, if you can't take the whole of Tehran into a bunker, then I can't go to a bunker. How do people in Iran look at that? Do they say, well, we need our leaders to actually stay safe to take us through this existential crisis? Or do they understand and accept this approach, which seems to be quite different from Western leaders who, even in peacetime, won't dare to walk among their people? And of course, we also saw Dr. Pezeshkian, the president, Dr. Larijani, and Dr. Araghchi, the foreign minister, among other officials, all walking in the streets on Al-Quds Day just a few days ago. Give me your thoughts about that.
Well, I think what especially people in the West do not understand is how the values and principles around which the Islamic Republic is established are very, very different from those in the West, where the governments are established around plutocracy and other notions. To just give you an example, I mean, before getting to why these people are not seeking to be in bunkers and seek protection, for example, in the United States, Everyone knows how Donald Trump got into power, how much money he has, and he brags about the money he has made, how he brags about having evaded paying his taxes. And or I don't know, like in the UK, the royal family's wealth is not controversial at all. Like people talk about, for example, how much money was spent on a royal wedding, and that's totally accepted. Whereas in Iran, one thing that people will try to, like when they want to criticize their officials, is talking about the wealth that they have accumulated, especially after coming into power. I mean, if you're coming from a rich family, that's a different story. But even in that case, it's not accepted in our society for an official to live a luxurious life. They are advised, and according to Islamic teachings, to live like the poorest of, or like the working class, to keep a very simple life. And people do not accept that. I mean, if someone has accumulated a lot of wealth, the people will revolt against the government. They won't accept that. They will criticize them, and they want them out of power. And usually they would not vote for someone who has become very rich, especially after coming to power. So the same thing is about their security. Officials get their popularity by living like everybody else in terms of, you know, their lifestyle, but also in terms of their security. So if you pay attention to, for example, the videos of the leader's speeches, where he delivers his speeches, there is not even a carpet. It's a very, very simple rug. And you don't see any item, any like expensive or luxurious item, because he said that he wants to live like the poorest of the population. And because he wants to feel what they go through, he wants to tell them that I am like you. I'm not different. You have elected me, but it doesn't mean that I'm superior to you. I'm just taking this responsibility to protect the country. And the same with when the war happens, all of these officials were saying that we want to live like everybody else in the country. And they also believe in a higher power. So when it's time for this to come, it will come, and no one can prevent it. And when it's not, no one can make it happen. So they want to live with dignity. They want to live up to their standards, up to their values that they have been raised to according to Islamic teachings. And as you said, like, actually, Imam Khomeini was very observant of the protocols that his security teams would say, but he would not allow that to the extent that would be very different from the rest of the country. So he said that he will continue working, going to his work, going to his office and doing his routines. And, you know, the rumors on the Western media were that, oh, he's going to flee to Russia, is going to, I mean, previously it would be, he's going to flee to Venezuela. He has this 40 floors, like, you know, basement down somewhere. There's a bunker that he's taking shelter. And all of a sudden, when they took him out, everyone realized that he was just living like an ordinary person in Tehran. And he did not feel that he's superior, he's different to the rest of the country. And these are the values that our politicians have tried to live up to. I'm not saying everyone is living up to that, but I mean, the nation also finds criticism in politicians who do not do that, who feel that they are exceptional and they have to be privileged and they have to be protected, because becoming an official in the Islamic Republic means taking a responsibility, not being privileged, not having more access to wealth and protection, but just being responsible for, which is very difficult. I mean, you have to sacrifice a lot to do that. And that's how our officials lived, all of them. And they take pride in becoming martyrs. I mean, martyrdom is the highest position and status that they can achieve, because, I mean, our leader was 86 years old. He knew that, you know, he's not going to live forever. And what's this is a more noble and proud than becoming martyred by at the hands of the worst satanic enemies you can imagine while you are protecting your country. That's the most beautiful elevation to the hereafter that you can achieve.
Dr. Sattari, as a scholar of North American studies and of U.S.-Iran relations, talk a little bit more about your analysis of why Iran is viewed with such hostility in the United States and the so-called West more generally. And what do you think the most important thing is for people in the West to know right now that they're not being told by their leaders and by Western media?
Well, the United States hostility towards Iran started well before the Islamic Republic. In 1953, when the CIA orchestrated a coup against Dr. Mossadegh, who was our first prime minister democratically elected. And by the way, he was not religious. He was secular, you can say. And he was not chanting death to America. He was not talking about Israel at all. He just wanted to nationalize Iran's oil. And he was toppled by the CIA through a military coup against his government. And that's when also the U.S. started sanctioning Iran. They installed a dictatorship, the Pahlavi dictatorship, and the Savak worked with Mossad to torture Iranian dissidents. And once we had the revolution in 1979, the popular revolution, and then a referendum where more than 98% of the population voted yes to the Islamic Republic, we started establishing a model, probably for the first time in the region, against the imperialist powers. We said no to imperialism and we caught the hands of the United States from our country. We gained control over our natural resources. And Iran started setting an example for the entire world that it is possible as a country. You know, when we came out of the revolution, we did not really have anything, and they staged a war through Saddam against us, and we still did not lose even an inch of our territories. And all of that, for 47 years, they've been imposing sanctions and everything. They have been trying to bring us to our knees so that they can gain control over Iran, over its resources, over its politics and everything. And they have not been able. So because they have failed in doing so, despite all the sanctions and aggression, now, what they are trying to do is forming this narrative of demonizing an entire nation and dehumanizing us in order to justify even more aggression and a war. The narrative always portrays Iran as, you know, sponsor of terrorism or state sponsor of terrorism or these fanatics and lunatics, which is very hilarious to me coming from the lunatics that are running the White House, and we know about them, that have been stealing and looting other nations' resources and money. And Iran sets a very, very dangerous example for the entire world, because we're telling the entire world that it is possible for a nation to stand against imperialism, even if they put sanctions on you, even if they isolate you. And for many years, the propaganda has worked. I mean, the Western audience had no other channel of information to know what exactly is happening in Iran than the Western mainstream media. But now with alternative media and social media, even though they're manipulating the algorithms and everything, the truth is coming out. You're seeing that a lot of people in the world are cheering on Iranian missiles hitting Tel Aviv and other occupied territories because they know who is the other side that Iran is fighting. So for the Western audience, I would say do not fall for this, you know, and they usually, because they have this Orientalist framing of what's happening inside Iran, especially when it comes to cultural things. Like, they're so obsessed about whether women are wearing a special form of hat. This is like not very different. I mean, people are choosing to wear this and some people don't. And you can see on the streets that there are a lot of women who don't want to wear it and they're not wearing it. But they use these cultural differences because it makes it very easy to otherize an entire nation. And they are trying to say that it was the 1979 revolution that forced Islam on this population, when in fact, we have been Muslim for more than 1,000 years. Nobody imposed Islam on us. Iranians have been Muslim for more than 1,000 years. I mean, this cultural heritage sites that we're talking about have been attacked, were built by Muslim rulers, and they have very beautiful and magnificent Islamic arts. What does that tell you about this place? These are all erased from the narrative because they want you to think that there's no legitimacy in the government that has been actually elected by these people. And of course, it's far from perfection, like any government in the entire world. But people have their agency. They're trying to bring about changes and improvements in their country, and they have been trying to resist imperialism. And we have learned that the reason that we're under attack is that we have been able to fight imperialism, and all their plots have been, I mean, they have failed in all the plots that they have had. And the last thing that they have resorted to is this war that we're seeing, which we see as an existential war, but for the U.S., it's a war of choice. And they're taking their last chances at bringing down the Islamic Republic of Iran as a nation and to balkanize the country and create perpetual chaos in the region so that they can loot our resources. And they will do everything to brainwash the people of the world to justify that. But it's, I think even that narrative is falling apart, and it's becoming more clear to the world that it's not about an Islamic regime or sponsoring terrorism. It's about two terrorist states attacking an independent nation because it dared resist imperialism.
Dr. Sitara Sadiqi, I think you're right about something, which is that something has changed. And even with the manipulation of the algorithms, particularly since the start of the genocide in Gaza, so many more people in the world are waking up to what is happening and what their rulers are doing, particularly in the West. And I think that this war in Iran is multiplying and amplifying that effect. And we are so grateful to you for all your insights today.
Thank you for this conversation. And it's always great to talk to you, Electronic Intifada.
That was Dr. Sitara Sadiqi, a professor at the University of Tehran. You're listening to Electronic Intifada Radio with me, Nora Barrows-Friedman. Music teacher Ahmed Muin Abu Amsha visited with and accompanied a new girls' choir in Khan Yunis. He says that, quote, beautiful young voices, full of positive energy and hope. This is just the beginning for them, and they really need support. Music is still alive in Gaza, and in Khan Yunis there is amazing energy. Wishing them all the success. The song they sing is called Tiri Tiri Yasvura, or Fly Fly Little Bird. And now it's time for the Electronic Intifada's Resistance Report with John Elmer.
This is the Resistance Report for day 895 of Israel's genocide, day 20 of the U.S.-Israeli war on Iran. Things are changing quickly, but this coverage of the third week of the war will never change. The U.S. bases in the region that have been targeted, particularly Bahrain, Kuwait, Qatar, the UAE, Saudi Arabia, Muwafaq al-Salti in Jordan, and then, of course, all across Israel, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps have said that they are dividing their operations 40% to Israel, 60% to high-value targets in U.S. positions throughout the Gulf region. So far, the U.S. has said that they've struck 7,800 targets in Iran. The IDF says 7,500 bombs dropped. The IRGC has fired more than 1,000 missiles, more than 3,000 drones, And Hezbollah and the Iraqi resistance have together carried out more than 1,000 operations. 1,300 people have been killed in Iran, 20,000 injured. About a dozen in Israel have been killed, and 12 more across the entire Gulf region for all of these operations by the Iranians. The massacre quotient is wildly disproportionate to the Israelis and the Americans, as always. As I said, those bases across the region have been targeted. High-value targets has been Iran's strategy, knocking out radar systems upon which the aerial defense array is dependent, preparing for a long war. They have been targeting these high-value targets early in the war that will make the later stages of the war a lot more difficult for the U.S. and Israel to defend, and the Gulf states are already way in over their head trying to defend their U.S. bases and installations in their territories and increasingly oil infrastructure and gas infrastructure after the targeting by Israel of the South Pars gas field. This video came out this week from a dash cam from a car who was beside an Israeli strike in Hamadan in the western area of Iran. And we're going to go to that now. So that was an attack on a nearby position, and you can just see from inside that car, first of all, the dignity and aplomb that the driver handled that pretty tense situation with, but just to give you an idea of what it's like to drive down a street in Iran at any point over these last 20 days. 36 ambulance stations have been damaged or destroyed. 6 hospital units completely out of service, and 18 healthcare frontline paramedics have been killed. Of course, we're seeing that in Lebanon as well. And Iran said this week that 43,000 non-military locations have been damaged or destroyed so far in the first 20 days of this war. Essentially, what the U.S. is doing is concentrating its air defenses around a few key places. This is the Prince Sultan Air Base in Saudi Arabia, and Muwaffaq al-Salti in Jordan has the same kind of thing. These tankers, those are KC-135 aerial refueling tankers, and they were all globbed together on the tarmac. In this Wall Street Journal story, 5 Air Force refueling planes hit in an Iranian strike on Saudi Arabia. 5 U.S. Air Force refueling planes were struck and damaged on the ground at Prince Sultan Air Base in Saudi Arabia, according to U.S. officials. These are refueling aircraft that refuel the fighter jets in the air. It allows them to extend their range. It allows them to stay up in the air on their bombing sorties. They're a critical part of the overall asset infrastructure that the U.S. are using for this war. 2 of these planes apparently collide in the air. This is a statement from the United States Central Command about the loss of a KC-135 over Iraq, which it describes as friendly territory, although a lot of Iraqi resistance videos would suggest otherwise. One of the planes crashed, lost all 6 of the crew on board. The second plane managed to limp into Ben Gurion Airport, where the U.S. also has been using a civilian airport for its military assets. We saw dozens of these refuelers in Ben Gurion Airport. Some of the KC-135 pilots were talking about how near a miss that tail rudder being broken would be for landing and how close it was to losing 2 planes. Americans have said that it was over friendly airspace. It was not friendly fire. Supposition that the Americans are putting forward is that the planes collided. What we don't know and what we do know from Yemen is that incoming fire has made fighter jets and aircraft carriers change their course rapidly, drastic change of course that could have led to this accident as well. But so far, all we know is from the Americans, and we'll see if they tell us the full story about this. But now, because of the five on the tarmac in Saudi Arabia and the two more here in Ben Gurion, seven critically important strategic assets are out of the battle here now. So let's move to Iran. Just to say, more than 200 American soldiers have been wounded. That is the number that the Americans are going with at this point right now. But again, really dragging their feet on casualty numbers coming out from the United States and also from Israel, unsurprisingly. So let's move to Iran's response. The Shahed 136 drone has been wreaking havoc across the region. And then their ballistic missile collection, which puts them as one of the world's top missile countries. Those have been used, the Imad, the Fatah, which travels at hypersonic speeds, and the Karamshar 4, which has a 2-ton warhead or also a submunitions warhead. Although what you'll hear from the Americans and from the Israelis is that 90% drop in drones and missile firing from day one. But that's not how you evaluate a war. First of all, day one is of the war is generally a shock and awe type approach, which means you use much more on the first day than you would in the days to follow. But it's also not Iran's strategy to just dump their missile stocks. They're planning for a long war, a war of attrition, a war that once it ends, they still have the ability to defend themselves. And so they have been striking high-value targets, advanced radars, military industrial base of Israel, targeting U.S. bases that have basically destroyed most of these bases. And that has been what their strategic aim has been. So the Americans prattling on about how there's 90% less missiles from the first day is mostly a statement about how many missiles there were on the first day, not a drop in the missiles. The missiles have been steady. The Israelis consistently talk about 8 and 9 missile attacks each day, sending people to the shelters up and down Israel. The Fatah hypersonic travels at Mach 16, has a maneuverable re-entry vehicle, makes it a survivable and accurate missile. This is the Khaibar Shaykan family of missiles that people may remember are what the Ansar Allah movement used. They call theirs the Palestine 2, and we saw that being used to target Israel. For their part, Ansar Allah has stayed on the sidelines of this battle. They have the ability to really choke the international economy if they were to shut down the Red Sea and the Suez Canal. This was the debut of the Sigil, one of the more advanced and newest of the IRGC Aerospace Force missile production. This was released first in 2023. The multi-stages missile makes a problem for missile defense. So a sophisticated missile, the civilian targets have not been the objective of the Iranians. They are trying to keep, it seems, the escalation in place and not climb the escalation ladder. Because right now, I think from Iran's point of view, they believe that they're winning this war. They have the global economy by the throat. They have the American bases in the region in a very uncertain future. And they have been saving their missiles, especially their advanced missiles, for the period after the targeting of these radars that we have seen in every Gulf state all around. They're targeting Nevatim Air Base. Nevatim is south of Beersheba in the Negev Desert, and it has been a target in all three of the previous True Promise operations. Censorship does prevent us from seeing what is happening and what is being hit on those air bases, which are regularly being targeted. You can see that in the field reports by the IRGC about those targets. The two main air defense systems, the THAAD system, we know the radar was knocked out. Its key advanced early warning radar was knocked out. $500 million radar knocked out. The Patriot system is firing $4 million interceptors. The THAAD interceptors are $15 million. Iran is still downing drones. The IRGC are apparently using their Majid air defense system for these takeouts. And the number that the Iranians claim is 120 drones between the Israelis and Americans taken out. We haven't seen the numbers broken down specifically, but we have for sure seen dozens on air. These are Iranian army drones launching, used all over the Gulf to target bases. Now let's take a look at the Iraqi resistance. They have got drone operations going on as well. The Islamic resistance in Iraq is an umbrella group. It has links that go back to Qasem Soleimani and the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, Quds Force, training these forces during the U.S. occupation of Iraq and the greater war on terror in the region. So in a lot of ways, we're seeing come together fighting forces that were prepared by the same organizations fighting in this war. The targets of these operations, there's been more than 500, the embassy building in Baghdad burning. U.S. bases in Kurdistan, 50 operations, 48 by drones and 2 by missiles. This is just by one group, Guardians of the Blood Brigades. They've targeted Camp Victory in Baghdad 21 times, 17 times by drones and 4 by missiles. Targets in Syria, 11 operations, 9 by drones. In Jordan, 13 operations, all by drones. They've also targeted Saudi Arabia, 9 operations, all drones, and also Kuwait, 6 operations, all by drones. So that's one group, 110 operations just by this group over 15 days. Al Jazeera reported yesterday that there's been more than 3,000 missiles and drones fired at the Gulf states. So pretty significant scale of operations from the Iraqi resistance that have been going on throughout this battle. They joined the battle on the first day. This is interesting. This is footage showing Bahrain being used for HIMARS launches, ballistic missile launches by the U.S. at Iran. A video verified by the New York Times shows the ballistic missiles being launched from Bahrain in the direction of Iran in what appears to be the first confirmed instance of an attack on the Islamic Republic originating from a Persian Gulf country since the war began, using the country for offensive operations. This was revealed by accident in a propaganda video by CENTCOM. Bahrain, at least, is being used for offensive operations. You can guess that they're not alone in that. Since the United States and Israel began the war on Iran earlier this month, more than 100 missiles and 200 drones have been launched at Bahrain, mostly concentrated on the United States 5th Fleet, which is the naval command for CENTCOM and one of its 3 crucial bases in the region, with Al Udeid in Qatar, and then the bases in Kuwait are also key. So that is the Iran front. We are going to move now to Lebanon and take a look at operations in Lebanon. More than 1 million displaced persons already in Lebanon, approaching 1,000 killed, 2,200 wounded, including 38 healthcare and paramedic workers, 74 wounded among healthcare workers. We saw that rocket barrage along the border wounded Israeli Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich's son. That got a lot of attention. But the information is being held tightly by Israel on this front as usual. But let's take a look at Naim Qassem, the chief of Hezbollah here. This is the speech from Sheikh Naim Qassem from a couple of days ago. He says, "Let it be clear, the battle we are waging is the battle of the resistance and the people of the resistance against the Israeli aggression on Lebanon. We have taken on as resistance the lessons and morals of the previous battle. The enemy's threats do not scare us, and the enemy will see our strength. There is no such thing as defeat or surrender in our dictionary. We will remain in the field regardless of the sacrifices. We will not retreat. This is our country. We will not allow anyone to control its fate, its decisions, and how its people live." He said, "This is an existential battle. We have prepared ourselves for a long confrontation. The word now is for the field." So the word now, as Hezbollah likes to say, as Nasrallah used to say, watch the field now. We're beyond words. And this is showing Hezbollah's readiness for this battle that have been impressive. A rate of operations by Hezbollah that exceed any of the previous rounds of battle after October 7th, including the focused war on Lebanon and Hezbollah at the end of 2024. So their pace of operations is higher now. Hezbollah has carried out 426 operations as of yesterday, and they go round the clock. No let up in Hezbollah operations. The IDF said 150 rockets a day are being fired. So Hezbollah has rejoined the war in full force and full capability, which is something that if you listen to Western defense analysts, you were told was impossible because they had been degraded. Not true. They are on the battlefield stronger than ever. We're seeing several tanks hit each day. According to the Israelis, there's been more than 1,100 strikes so far in Lebanon. Israel believes that there's 1,000 Radwan special forces that are below the Litani River ready for that battle. The Israelis have 3 divisions right now spread across the Lebanon border. So they are planning to battle what they think are 1,000 Radwan forces. Unclear how good their intelligence are on that. I would suspect not great. Israel told us that they had destroyed some untrue number, percentage of Hezbollah's missile and rocket capability. But those numbers coming into the war were believed to be in the tens and hundreds of thousands for each type of missile. They're 122-millimeter Grad rockets. They had 100,000 of them. So even if some percentage of them were knocked out, they still have significant capabilities. And that's what Naim Qassem was talking about in his speech, that we are ready for a long fight. We are prepared for it. We have shifted with the lessons learned from the previous battle, and we are applying them on the ground in this battle. When Israel says it's invading Lebanon, you need to look at this surroundings. You need to see the bush, the trees, the mountains, what it means to truly invade and not just tell your people in a press release that you're going to fight, because this is a very difficult battle space. And it's not like Gaza, where they carry out the operations, they have video of it, they send a runner to get the video. Here you have fighters in positions spread out all across many, many miles of the south. And the distance that they have between them and the Israelis is also a significant distance, which is why you see those anti-tank guided missile strikes taking so long to get there, and how good a shot it is to get it to cover those multiple kilometers, more than 5 in some cases. Fabian Hintz from the International Institute for Strategic Studies noted that on the Iranian cruise missile, that he noticed jamming resistance, CPRA antenna for satellite navigation on that. So even more difficult to bring down. And they said that this battle is existential and that they're prepared to be in the field for the entire battle as long as is necessary, which maybe isn't quite the same language that we heard during the October 7th Lebanon front. So we'll have to keep our eyes peeled on that. That is the Lebanon front. And this has been the resistance report for day 895 of Israel's genocide in Gaza and day 20 of the U.S.-Israeli war with Iran.
That was the Electronic Intifada's John Elmer. Thank you for tuning into Electronic Intifada Radio. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. For more interviews, reports, and analysis, along with feature articles, podcasts, and our live stream, check out electronicintifada.net. Produced by Pierre Loisel, Nora Barrows-Friedman, and Tamara Nassar. The Electronic Intifada is a program service of the Middle East Cultural and Charitable Society, Incorporated, a 501c3 nonprofit organization.
We'll start with some general ways to turn ugly duckling emotions into swans. First.
Rock. Rock, rock, rocket.
Second.
Rock. Rock, rock, rocket.
Third. This is what one doctor suggests. We'll be right back.
Number 7. Now, look forward in a positive mode. Start by spending a few minutes
each Thursday at 10 p.m. listening to Bright Side of the Poo. What's it about?